My name is Henry Chen. I'm an educator who teaches stock investing. Words are to motivate people to take action.
Hi, welcome to the Writer's Rotation podcast. I'm your host, Kathy Stamps. I love words and writing and people and talking. So I'm talking to people who write all kinds of things in different professions. It's a writer's rotation.
Henry!
How are you, Kathy?
Good. How you doing?
Good.
I love that you consider yourself an educator.
That's what I've always thought writing was and books are and courses are. It's just to educate people. And then really, as I really thought about it, educating is really just to, it's not about knowledge. It's about to get people to take action, to do something with it.
That's a nice little mic drop. New York City?
New York City, yeah.
Is this a lifelong?
I've been here over 10 years, like 12 years or so. I've been here for some time. I came from Hong Kong. I grew up partially there, but I was born in the US.
Do you speak different languages?
I speak a little bit of Chinese.
Someone told me that math is a language too. I think you're very involved with math.
It's more, I'm involved with a lot of numbers. It's like everything is communicated with numbers in finance.
So you're saying that math and numbers are two different things?
Yeah, I guess so. The math, for the most part in stock investing and markets in general, the maximum amount of math would be like multiplication and addition and a compounding function. So a permutation, but that's it. That might be a lot, but.
I have a theory about multiplication and addition are very liberal. They're generous because you can add 6 + 2 + 4 or 4 + 2 + 6 or something that doesn't matter. And division and subtraction are very conservative. You can only do it this way.
Yeah, I guess so.
Do you like that?
Yeah, multiplication gets to where all the good stuff happens. Yeah, pretty much. And then compounding is just multiplication over and over again. That's
the rule of 72.
Rule of 72, yeah.
I know some of your phrases. I've completely forgotten what that means, but it's something about interest coming in or interest going out.
Uh-huh.
You have different nomenclature for that. If you're paying 36% interest, then it's going to take you 2 years to owe double what you borrowed.
Yeah.
Is that true? Or what you invested?
Yeah, well, it's the rule 72.
But what does that mean? Yeah. 72 what's? I don't understand.
Right. So say if we're using that, say 36, just to be specific.
That's half of 72.
Half of 72. So 72 is just if you were to compound 36%, so 1.35 times 1.35, it would equal to 2. So it's just a rule of thumb just to be able to think in compounding terms really quickly. That's all the rule 72 is. Because if you have something that's growing at 10%, then you're like, okay, so that's about 7 years to double my money or double anything.
Oh, because how many tens are there in 72?
Exactly. Yeah. Oh. So then 20% would be like, about 3.5 years, something like that.
So is it always years?
Yes. I mean, it depends on the structure of the, you know, the loan or the interest rate, because sometimes they compound monthly. Like credit cards would compound monthly because they charge an interest rate.
Or every minute.
Yeah. So you could technically compound every minute. And if you go to the max, the mathematical nth degree would be an E function. I don't know if you...
I remember on the calculator when you used to put too many things in and it just went E, 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 E. Is that what you mean?
No. Like, it's like a not, it's like a, so I'm not actually a mathematician, but it's not like, it's not like a real number, right? It's like a, it's a placeholder for, yeah. So you're right. So it'd be like compounding to the infinite tiniest standpoint. It would be an E function.
Okay. So which came first, your love of numbers or money or finance or what? What's your story?
Yeah, it probably started off with money and finance. I know this sounds like kind of weird, but I grew up in Hong Kong. So it's a very financial focused, just all the main industry was finance. As a kid, I saw like the people who worked in finance, they had all like the nice suits and they were really smart and they had a lot of money. So I was like, okay, cool. I want to do that, stuff like that. And then I got into markets because I was interested in history and like society and looking at things from a high level. And then I started to read about these traders or these investors, and they would do things like they would think really big picture. And I don't know if you ever heard of like someone like George Soros, but
I know the name, I think.
Yeah. So like one of the stories that I was just captivated by was one time him and his fund and it's like Stanley Druckenmiller. They had this trade going on where they bet against the pound before the euro was around. You know, and there was like a economic reasoning behind that, like the England economy was slowing, so there was like a recession coming. They expected the Fed would have, or the Central Bank of England would have to lower their rates, which would normally cause the pound to decline. But the pound had fixed their currency relative to the Deutschmark, the German currency. And so they had this setup where the Bank of England says, like, we're not going to move our exchange rate. But they're like, well, no, you have to, because you're going to be forced to by the economy. And then they bet, I think, like $1 billion. And then they were betting against the Bank of England. They were like, you're going to have to lower your interest rates. And I don't think there's that many cases like this, but they bet against the Bank of England. And then, like, the markets eventually turned against the Bank of England. So the Bank of England had to lower their rates. They broke the exchange peg. I think he made like $1 billion, like that fund made $1 billion in one go. That's what they call it, that he broke the Bank of England.
Okay.
So I thought that was cool.
And did you go to school for this?
No. I didn't do any math or finance. I mean, I did science in high school, and then college. I studied a variety of things at Brown, and then just tried every single class I could.
Well, that's cool. What's your degree in?
Philosophy.
The allegory of the cave.
Yes, like Plato. I did like moral philosophy, yeah, like Aristotle and Kant. And
that's cool. And what did you do out of school?
So out of school, I wanted to go into finance, but I graduated in 2009, right after the financial crash. Not very smart.
The career placement office was like, well?
There was nothing. There was one job when I graduated. We're like recruiting on campus. One job at Goldman Sachs. Like one out of the entire class. Yeah, we all had to, our whole class, we just had to all scramble, just figure out whatever we could get.
But I saw in your bio, you worked on Wall Street.
I did, yeah. So I eventually started off as like a temp in this small research firm that covered Wall Street. So it was like a strategic research firm, which was interesting because, well, first I started off as like a receptionist. So I wasn't really doing anything, but then I was like, I really want to be an analyst. And the work itself is pretty funny. Like the work itself, they would interview executives, right? Like like the head of a trading desk. And because they would interview all these trading executives and write research to give them like an idea of what's going on strategically and give them advice. And so then just because I think because I was prepared to do all the, like I did philosophy, so I was used to writing and thinking in abstract terms, I could do the job, even though I had no experience doing any of that, but I was like advising executives from my research. And then I went to Wall Street after that.
And is it as crazy as the movies?
No, it's boring.
Really?
It's super boring. No, all the fun stuff was in the 80s when it was really getting going.
Greed is good.
Yeah, like the Wall Street. I think I hear stories. I kind of wish I was there, but in the 80s, that's when it was really crazy because that's when the market like kind of took off on a new product. It got deregulated and it was a new industry. So there was all these like, it was like a lot of random people coming in and they were making a lot of money and having a lot of fun. When I came in, I was also in equity research, which is not, I guess it used to be exciting too, but it, you know, it was like, it's very quiet. It's like very bookish. You're a lot of people just reading and.
Aww. Well, that sounds sweet.
Yeah, it's actually not that bad. I enjoyed it.
And you've written books.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, so I worked in equity research for a couple of years and I did like it. And there's a lot of writing involved in that. I left because I got a little bored. I was a little stuck. I was like in this big institution. At that point in time in the industry, everyone's just working for these big institutions. Everyone's just working for the biggest funds or the richest people. So I felt like it was a little bit meaningless. It's not meaningless, but it's, I wanted to do something else. Anyway, so I left and then I was like, I spent almost 10 years studying this topic and I realized that a lot of the stuff I learned is like completely counter to what most individual investors are taught. And at least from what my experience was, so I was like, I really want to at least capture this knowledge because I'm probably not going to go back. And then a book was a vehicle. I was like, okay, maybe I can communicate this through a book. And then that turned into a big project of writing about stock investing. So yeah, then that turned into a book.
You've written magazine articles too.
I have.
Did those come first?
Yes. So at Tab Group, which is where I first started, all of our work was just writing. We're writing research reports and we talk to journalists. So we'd write articles, I would speak at conferences. And then equity research, we'd write to communicate our ideas and motivate investors to act on our ideas. I never thought of myself as a writer, but everything I've been doing so far is all writing related.
That's very cool. Do you feel like you had a leg up?
Writing wise?
Yeah. From some of your compatriots, or were they all pretty good writers also?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I never really thought of it as like a skill?
Writing is not a skill.
It's definitely a skill. It's like a craft. Now I realize this really is a craft. But I remember, like, when I first started, I wrote an article like, oh, this is what JP Morgan would do during the recession. Just as an opinion, having an article and kind of referencing the historical period and a character and kind of having some actionable kind of like advice in there. That was like one of the first things I wrote. And then I remember, like, maybe a couple of years later, we hired this guy who was like really experienced and he just couldn't write. Like, he couldn't do the work. So I was like, okay, maybe I was trained somehow with all my reading and writing over the years.
Were you pretty good at it as a kid?
No, I think I just read a lot of books.
Yeah, because some kids don't. They just don't read. They don't like to read.
Yeah, I think it's honestly a function of reading, right? Writing, because because all the ideas I had just came from all that words just put in my head. And then the phrases are really just mixes of everything that I've read. Obviously, the vocabulary. So... yeah. And I think maybe because I was more used to consuming information and learning through books and reading as opposed to listening. Like, I didn't go to class usually, which is read. So I think it's the reading that really, and like, I'd be journaling all the time. I think because I had so many things in my head, I had to write it out. So maybe that helped.
Do you do the mental well-being journaling also?
What's that?
You know, just here are my thoughts. I'm going to get them out on paper.
Oh, let's see. I think what one point in my life I tried to do that, but I don't know if it was super helpful. I think that there's so much thought going on. It wasn't actually that conducive to let it kind of rain even more with the writing. I think just for my personal self, it's more helpful to write about my feelings as opposed to my thoughts.
Oh, interesting. And what is the difference between your feelings and your thoughts?
Well, the feelings are more reflective. They're the reaction to things, I guess. The honest reaction to things. The thoughts are just made up.
That's fascinating.
This is a philosophical way to think about it. I guess this is like a stoicism type of thing. Like, everything is just, you get stuff coming in and then you have an interpretation, which is your thoughts. And then really the thoughts, there isn't really any basis reality, but how you feel about things is a true reaction.
Ooh, okay. I like that. Who is your favorite Stoic?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm that versed in it. I've only read Marcus Aurelius and Seneca. Seneca was good. I like Seneca.
Was that his first name or his last name? Who knows?
I don't know. I think it's his last name.
Okay, writing. What's your writing process?
Writing process is I will usually handwrite everything first, even when it's like when I'm doing these lessons or teaching something. I will usually always sketch things out by hand, bullet points, and then sometimes I'll create a structure and then I'll fill that in with the typing, with the writing. But sometimes it's like the writing things down and then I might write it down in a different iteration another day. And then another day, it might be another. It's like the same variant of the idea. And then eventually a concept comes out. I'm not exactly sure. I don't know if my process is that effective, but it's just a lot of writing things down.
That sounds very Mozart. Variations on a theme.
Yeah, yeah. Because I find when I've organized my notes, they're like, there's recurring themes, there's recurring ideas. They just get more refined each time.
That's cool. Tell us about your book.
So stock investing is like making investments in companies that are trading on the stock market. And the practice of it is, it kind of combines a number of things. But what I done in my work and what most people would consider is investing is studying the business and in part of that analyzing or reviewing its financials or its numbers and understanding the business and understanding how that impacts the price of the stock or just the stock itself. When I talk about the stock, I'm really talking about the stock price. So that whole practice of how do you go about studying a company, evaluating a company and all the different elements of how do you price a stock, when do you buy it, situations that can make you money, those things are all put together, I would bucket as fundamental investing. And that's what I put in the book. It's a guide for someone who is interested in fundamental investing, but doesn't necessarily have like a financial background or is like trained in it. I wanted to write something for that kind of investor.
And that sounds fairly evergreen, because I would think some of this would be very specific to today, this week, this month.
Yes, that was my vision. Yes, to try to keep it as evergreen as possible. Yeah, because for sure, there's always these case by case basis. Yeah, because a lot of the times when you're investing, there's a lot of patterns. So maybe this type of situation you notice it as a pattern, like, okay, maybe stocks come down. There's like some sort of catalyst, which just means an event that could change the price. But I was trying to hone it into the more principles, like, okay, these are like the economic principles of how a business performance gets translated into a stock price. And then how do you interpret that? And where do you get the information? And how do you research it and think about it?
Investing in a stock, is there truly a minimum? I just assume you need $20,000. You know, anything in the thousands, I'm like, I'm out.
Well, it's so if we take a step back and think about investing overall, right? The goal is, okay, you have some capital or some money. You want to have that money make more money for you, right? Get more returns.
ROI.
Really the ROI, exactly. There's actually another component. There's the ROI, the potential return, and then there's a potential risk. And then there's a time frame involved. So really the whole practice of picking what to do with your money is just figuring out what is your target return, what is your risk that you're willing to deal with, and what's your time frame. Then stocks has a specific profile that's related to that. Like if you invest in the stock market, like the S&P 500, that'll give you about an annual return, about 10%, not guaranteed, because they also have a lot of volatility of about like 10 to 12%. So it means it'll fluctuate 10 to 12%. And then the time frame is
dollar cost averaging.
Yeah. So that's why dollar cost averaging works, because
just I don't know what it means. I know your words.
Oh, well, that's good. I mean, that just means continually putting money in the market, because then you take advantage of the fact that, generally speaking, 9 out of 10, historically, the stock market is going to go up. So you're just on probability alone, it makes sense to keep buying.
So I think with bringing in the feelings, I think people who are desperate, it's not going to work.
Yes.
And people who have like some chill.
Yes.
And the actual knowledge, explain that to the court.
No, totally. The challenge of investing is that it requires a decision-making process that our brains are not naturally used to doing. It requires thinking long-term. It requires thinking and compounding. And it requires, like, when a stock goes down, that creates an emotion, because money will create emotion.
Panic, yes.
If you lose money or if you make money, right? And those emotions are not necessarily helpful when it comes to investing.
Money is so emotional.
It is very emotional.
The shame
mm-hmm.
that can be around it. Oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
I want to write about that. I want to write either fictional or nonfiction, because I think they're going to be the same.
Uh-huh.
Everyone's story. So-and-so is X number of euros and has no money. So-and-so and has no, and how all these different people have the same thought. I have no money.
Mm.
And how very different it looks.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tricky. It's like a real psychological thing. It represents so many different things.
It's crazy.
Yeah, there's so much emotion attached to it, even though it's technically just a number. And it's a piece of information, but because it represents so many meaningful things.
Piece of paper.
Yeah, it's a piece of paper. Represents like a transaction, or represents value created or work done or whatnot. And then investing just represents future value. But then there's all these emotions related to it, because obviously, if you have a lot of money, you can get nicer things and nicer experiences. And then people try to stack other people societally based off money. But it's not reflective of anything really beyond just value.
The value that we attach to it, that we ascribe to it.
Yes, the value we attach to it, and usually in reflecting in the products and services in the market. Yeah, it's the big topic.
With your reading as a child and now, fiction, nonfiction, both, either?
Let's see. When I was growing up, it was a lot of fiction. And then after I graduated college, it was a lot of nonfiction. And then it was like different fields. It was like health stuff. Then it was a lot of self-development stuff. Then a lot of finance, business stuff. A lot of nonfiction. And then before that, I was doing a lot of like fantasy novels and stuff like that when I was a kid. Dungeons and Dragons type of stuff. Yeah, I would like to read more books. I did like Neal Stephenson recently. He's like a science fiction stuff. He's cool.
Money is very science fiction.
I guess so. Money is kind of science fiction.
What are you working on now?
I am working on a course. Well, the course is almost done, but it's a course on teaching investors fundamental investing, and kind of showing them how to do this, how to implement fundamental investing so they can pick stocks, get higher returns, and increase their wealth, achieve financial freedom faster. That's the goal of teaching this material.
Very cool. And is this your full-time gig?
Yes. This is currently a full-time gig, yeah. Self-employed. My plan is to create this into a business, educating investors, teaching stock investing, and making that into a thing. That is my goal. I mean, the kind of goal is to systematize this process of stock investing and then really figure out how to teach it effectively using technology. I think that could have like a nice little impact and be beneficial for people. That's kind of the high level purpose.
Does this industry change like rapidly or dinosaurally or in between?
Yeah, so it does change very rapidly. The financial industry has usually been the first to adopt technologies. So like trading back in the 80s, it was the first to start using like Excel and computers to model companies. It was the first one to use high-speed data. Before the internet was invented, like there was these communication networks for people to get information really fast. And obviously they were using phones and chat. So they're always at the forefront. At the same time, the asset management industry, so the people like the mutual fund industry, that is literally has been on fire for like the past, like on fire as in burning down right now for the past 10 years, because the innovation in the financial industry was the ETF, which is the index-based fund. To simplify, effectively means that instead of you having a mutual fund manager who's going to pick your stocks, the ETF uses an index, which is a computer-generated list of stocks.
Would the E stand for electronic and the F stand for fund and the T is, I don't know, something?
The F is for fund. It's exchange-traded fund. So that has kind of revolutionized the industry. It's like 50% of all assets, equity assets, are managed by ETFs or indexes, which are quantitatively computer generated lists of stocks that people are buying.
No people.
80% of 401ks are going into ETFs and index funds, which means 80% of people's retirements are computer generated going into the top 500 companies in the US. Yeah, sorry, I'm throwing a lot of investing stuff at you.
No, it's very interesting. What do you say when you meet someone and they ask what you do?
I tell them I have a course business and a book teaching people stock investing.
Do you think your stuff is geared more toward people who know nothing or people who think they know everything?
Currently, it's like the book is a little bit broader. I think it would apply for anyone who's interested in managing their own money or picking stocks, just interested in the stock market in general. The course is a little bit more, currently it's a little bit more niche. It's more focused on people who are the idea of picking their own stocks and making their own investments. And obviously the appeal that you can make a lot more money when you pick your own stocks, like 10x more than what you would do with just buying a market fund. And it's also an enjoyable experience for some of those people because it combines a little bit of betting, so risk-taking, and you're also studying businesses and markets. So if you enjoy that, like it's just a way that you can make money by pursuing your own curiosity.
Well, I do live in Kentucky and we do have some racetracks.
So it's similar, yeah. The betting system is very similar to how prices work in the stock market in terms of how they're priced.
Usually I just put $2 on 2 and 6 or box the exact.
Uh-huh.
I haven't been in so long. Or the color of the silks, uh-huh. You know, or the color of the horse and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the buyer numbers will tell you what was the time, how did the horse come in. So what the expert gamblers tell you is you want to look at consistency. So you want to look for consistency, and that's the one you put your money on.
Ah, it's similar in stocks. You look for predictable businesses. So it is similar.
Oh, and you know when you say the SEC, it's the Southeastern Conference. So it's the other SEC.
The other SEC, the one in DC, the boring one.
There you go. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Kathy. Nice chatting with you.
Thanks, Henry.
All right, bye.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writer's Rotation. Like and subscribe for more. And remember, writing is a marketable skill. Smiling is a remarkable skill.